So we were looking in the last chapter at this idea of turning inward. We're looking at time. We're looking at the possibility of not being caught up in the subjective time of the self, or certainly an objective time, or just more generally we can say not being caught up in linear temporality, and its from-to structure. All that is by way of a short review of what was going on in the last chapter. So then the question gets raised at the beginning of this chapter, how can we do it? How can we turn inward? And I just want to emphasize at the outset, because it's always good to remember this in TSK, that this is not a theoretical question. No, it's not like asking, well, how could we imagine that it might be possible to turn inward or to experience time differently? The question is always, what's going on in our experience? What's it like for us? What is the impact in our lives of learning to or experimenting with seeing things in this different way? So I know that's a point we've gone over quite a bit, but it's always good to remember, because sometimes you wind up kind of, scratching your head trying to figure out what Rinpoche means, and you forget that coming up with some sort of a good answer to that question in terms of concepts does not yet mean that you are putting it into practice. And that really is what TSK is about. That's why it's a vision instead of a theory. So what Rinpoche says at the beginning of the chapter is that it seems like it would be very difficult to make contact with this dynamic temporality, because he gives two reasons. One is that time doesn't show up in time. If there's some dynamic that allows events and objects to appear, that dynamic is not going to show up within the dynamic. And the other problem that he mentions is that we tell stories, or we live stories, we inhabit stories. That's the way, our usual way of knowing, and of course that's what we want to be questioning, but that's the way it usually works. You can't, telling a story about time is not the same as contacting the time that makes it possible to tell the story. So it's the same issue that comes up again and again. It's kind of a question of levels or orders. You, on the ordinary level of experience, you can't investigate what makes ordinary experience possible. And you could think about that in terms of space. You could say, well, space is not an object in space, so how can we ever know space? And we've investigated that in the past. The same thing is true here with respect to time. And then Rinpoche makes an interesting move, which is what the chapter really is about, and it's at the top of page 116. He says one way to contact the dynamic that's involved in telling stories, and that's that turning inward dynamic of time, would be to tell a story, and I'm quoting here in the first full paragraph, we can tell a story that in its telling evokes a no-stories knowing. And that's really what the chapter is about. It's not as though at the end of the chapter, Rinpoche then has a paragraph where he says, "So you see, now we understand how that's possible." But I do think that's kind of the guiding theme for what the chapter is about. Now, this week we're only covering the first half of the chapter, so even if there were sort of a nice, neat, tidy ending, which there's not, we wouldn't get to it this week. We would be left hanging. But that's all right, because, you know, the point is not to tell a story that is coherent in exactly the way that our stories are usually coherent. The point is to let the telling itself be a kind of knowing. And so the question that we're going to look at is whether that works. Is that effective? So then Rinpoche starts telling this story, and the first thing he says is he starts from the past, and we start on page 116 in the conductor's story, and he talks about the unfolding momentum of time. And I want to say something about momentum in just a little bit, but at this point I want to focus more on what he says about the past. Because, you know, we start off with this impression, you could say, that everything that happens arises out of a past. We're already in the beginning committed to the idea of a past, present, future structure, and everything shows up out of the past. And now the past, he says, blossoms into sensations, agitations, and expectations. The reason that the past can do that, I mean, I think it's quite clear from the way he presents it here, is that there is a structure that we have given. There's a momentum of time, and the momentum of time takes a certain structure, and that structure is a past, present, future structure. So then the past has its role to play. And when we accept that structure or enter into it, and, you know, it's always already there. It's a structure that we've accepted before we realized we had any choice in the matter. So when we do that, then we also get accept the whole notion of causality as a very strong ordering principle. You know, one thing happens, and then another thing has to happen, and in that way, the story takes form. And what Rinpoche is saying here is it doesn't have to be that way, or that's going a little too quickly. What he's saying is that whole way of understanding, which is absolutely basic to us, and we just, you know, there's no doubt about it, that's the way things are, that way of understanding is the outcome of this underlying structure that we have imposed, the temporal order. And you could even say it's not that we've imposed it, because we as individual selves are also given as part of that temporal order. But that order sets us up for what Rinpoche calls at the top of page 117 the usual narratives, right? And really, most of this chapter is about what is called at the bottom of the next page, the heading, themes and variations. And I don't know if this is consistently carried through, but Rinpoche is kind of playing here on the notion of a musical piece or a symphony, right? We start off with the conductor, and then the themes get set into place. The themes get played out, and from then on, it's all themes and variations. That is our life. And the rest of the chapter, I think, is just a, you know, really powerful presentation of the themes and presentations of our lives, all of which carry with them a sense of limitation, a sense of incompleteness, all of the things that we know from our own experience. It all grows out of accepting and adopting this order. And in the second full paragraph on 117, Rinpoche says something really striking. In the middle of the paragraph, he says, "From one single thought, almost from one single word, we could conduct the whole. And, you know, we're not going to try to do it right now in this phone call, but that would be an exercise that is worth doing, I think. If you have a thought, to work out how the whole of the temporal order is implicated in that thought. So, you know, one example would be to say, well, here we are, we're having this phone call, we have one more week, we have an idea of this whole program or course, and how it fits into our lives. So if you imagine, let's say, at the, you know, shortly before you called up for this, to take part in this phone call, you had the thought, oh, it's time to do the phone call. For that thought to make sense, there has to be, you know, every single structure, really, that is implied or implicated in the stories that you accept has to be operating. And I think that's what Rinpoche is pointing to here. And it's actually an interesting clue or suggestion with respect to the question that I started with, which is, you know, Rinpoche is saying that we could tell a story which, in its telling, evokes a different kind of knowing. Well, you could say that what's going on here is that the story is a story about stories. It's a story about the way we tell and shape our lives. And because it's about stories, it helps us get clear about the nature of stories and the kind of knowing and its limitations. And if that's so, then we have the possibility of knowing differently, or at least, again, that's moving a little too quickly. I think we have to be careful here. We have the possibility of recognizing the limits on our ordinary time and our ordinary knowing, and that recognition gives us the possibility of turning inward, of contacting a different temporal dynamic, because the recognition takes us outside ourselves. It's like in therapy. We have several therapists in on this phone conversation, and I'm not a therapist, but you know, in the moment that the client or the patient has a certain recognition of the story that's operating, that recognition is a kind of a doorway to step outside the story and into a spacious, open place where the sun is shining, kind of like that, to use that metaphor. So, any comments about that? I always like to make a little bit of a pause, because otherwise I just talk and talk. Anybody want to say anything about that?
I have a question, Jack.
Yes.
It seems even when I have that recognition, there is still within the bigger perspective, there is still a story. It's a little more subtle and more expansive, but it doesn't seem that I get totally out of it, that I don't have this coherent storyline in the background.
Right. I think you're right about that. It's not an all or nothing thing. In other words, it's not the case that either we're telling a story or inhabiting a story, or we've just dropped the story structure entirely. Stories are nested. You know, there's one story inside another story inside another story. There's a couple of ways of thinking about that, and I'm not sure which is the most accurate. One is that you could say that there's a moment of recognition. This is the way I would tend to think about it myself. There's a moment of recognition, and that moment of recognition doesn't have anything to do with stories. That moment of recognition is more like, you know, suddenly the sun comes out from behind clouds or something like that. And then in the very next moment, a new story comes up, because that's what we're used to doing, And also because we're so dependent on stories that for that story structure to dissolve for a moment is frightening. It's a way of being that we're not used to. So in the next moment, a new story comes up, and it may take the form of something like, "Oh, I just recognized something," and then we're definitely back into a story structure. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is more what I said before, that that there are nested stories. You know, it's if you imagine being in a prison and you break through the first line of defense, you know, you're trying to escape, and you get through the first gate, let's say. And now you're in the courtyard, but there's going to be another gate, another locked gate, and there are going to be guards on the towers around the gate, and so on. So that's what I mean by nested stories. But I think you're absolutely right that the quality of breaking through, of recognizing a story in operation, is very helpful, but just doing it once, or even, you know, learning to recognize it again and again is still a process. It wouldn't have to be if we weren't committed to the idea of process, but we are, and so it's still a process, and it's going to take. I sort of hate to say it this way, but it's going to take time. But the recognition itself. The more we learn to see a story, to see through a story, the more we learn to recognize a story, the more we become familiar with that move, the more we begin to understand how stories and how the temporal order operates. Again, if we think of this chapter as asking the question, how can we turn inward to evoke the temporal dynamic? This is one answer that's being given, and it has to do with telling a story that helps us recognize stories. And so I don't know if you'd exactly call that a turning inward, if you think in just kind of in geographic terms. It's more like you find yourself outside. You know, you find yourself outside the story. So, I don't know, I'm not sure if that's the right image either in terms of space. But that's kind of the movement, I think, that the story is trying to, is offering us here. Anybody else? Any comment on that? Okay. There's a theme that comes up, or it's a theme if you're looking for it, but a number of times in this chapter, Rinpoche uses the notion of momentum. And what he says, and let's see, I'm looking on page, I think on 119, but I mean, I have a note here that says 119, but I don't see it at the moment, but he talks about momentum, and the notion is that once you get started in a certain direction, that is, once the story starts to unfold, there is a momentum that makes it very, very difficult for us to escape from. So, when I read that, I was interested, and I started thinking about it, because Rinpoche says this in a number of places in the TSK books, that there is that stories and the linear order have a momentum, and there's a particular place in Love of Knowledge I think we looked at in the previous course where Rinpoche talks about the self's desire. And he says, The force of the self's desire unfolds as the momentum of linear time, which is a really interesting statement, and I won't try to go into it right now. But there is always this sense of a momentum which becomes unstoppable. And you know, there isn't a way we can step out of it. That way, in other words, if we're caught up in the momentum, then we can't recognize what's going on. It's almost just a practical question because things are moving too quickly. There's no opportunity to step outside. There's no opportunity for recognition. So I started looking at this question of momentum, and there is another side to it, and I guess that's what was kind of interesting to me, because there is also a sense of the momentum of time as having something to do with the vitality of time, the dynamic aliveness of time, which is what we've been looking at and what we're interested in contacting. So in an earlier chapter, if you look at page 91 in the second full paragraph, he talks about that very explicitly. He says, such times of vitality, he's talking about how we do have these moments of dynamic aliveness. And then he says, such times of vitality reveal the momentum of time as a thrusting, driving presence. Now that could go in either direction, that the idea of a thrusting, driving presence. But then he goes on to say, when we awaken to this momentum, experience becomes something different from what it usually is. The interaction of identified entities gives way to shifting shapes unfolding in unbroken presentation. So that's the other side of momentum. If we could really see things taking form rather than focusing on what has taken form, on the identities that we have assigned, that would be another way, another kind of recognition, another way of connecting. I'm quite fond, as some of you know, of William James, among Western thinkers. He, although he wasn't very systematic and didn't go into things in the depth very much, he has a lot of interesting insights. And he makes the distinction at one point between, he's talking about the stream of consciousness. That's the phrase that he's really famous for. And he makes the distinction between the flights of a bird and the moments when the bird comes to rest, what he calls the perchings in English, you know, how a bird sits on a perch. And he says we're very familiar with the perches. That's all we ever look at. All we ever look at is the places where we come to rest for a moment. Everything stops. And that's what we think of as reality. But we never pay any attention to the movement, to the flight of the bird. And that's similar to this idea of momentum. So that's kind of the positive sense of momentum. But there are also some interesting discussions of it which go back a little more into the negative side. And the reason I'm kind of going back and forth here is because I think that this whole idea of telling a story about conducting time as a way into the dynamic of time, it'll really help if we understand something about momentum. So I just wanted to point out a couple of things. And there is, you know, very often I look in the index to a book, and I really care about indices. You know, when I'm editing books, it's always important to me to do a good index. But in this one, I noticed that, although I did this index, the word momentum, it's in the index, but I don't get all the instances. However, fortunately, we have the CD with all the books on it, and you can do a search there for the word momentum. So I did that. And anyway, I just want to give you a couple of places on, and these are in the introduction, so they're in Roman numerals. So if you go to Roman numeral 31, does anybody know if they still teach Roman numerals in school to kids?
Yeah.
They do? Okay, good. I'm glad, because that's a piece of knowledge we shouldn't lose. So on page 31, he's talking about, at the top of the page, intrinsic awareness. And then he says, an uncontrollable momentum carries us from one moment to the next. And he suggests how important it would be if we could escape from that. Right? Because he's describing that momentum as a kind of a restless momentum. He says, is it possible that we could relax this ongoing momentum and learn to be at home in a minding that moves in more stable rhythms? So that suggests the possibility that the dynamic could be different from the momentum that we're used to. And then again, a couple of pages later in Roman numeral 33, and this is actually very related to what this chapter is about, it seems to me. It's on the first full paragraph. He says, the real path inward, so it's exactly our theme, is turning inward. The real path inward opens differently. We transform the momentum of our knowing outward when we trace the present arising of that momentum. The dynamic that moves toward the known can also lead to the originating center of our awareness and our knowing. So this tracing of the dynamic that's described here and the telling of the story of conducting that this chapter is about, seems to me those are basically the same thing. And if you have the CD, you might want to look up some other instances of momentum and see if that helps you get clear on this, because it's obviously an important theme for helping to understand the significance of the temporal unfolding and how we can relate to it. So I wanted to call attention on page 121 to what he says comes out of the momentum, because at the very end of the first paragraph he talks about the momentum of time, which becomes ever more unstoppable. And he says that momentum gives you a sameness, right? A single-minded knowing, as he referred to it in a previous chapter. And here he says single-minded sameness. And then he says, so what do you get? You know, this is the sameness of the story. In other words, things show up if they fit within the story. We can acknowledge them. If they don't, then we just ignore them. Or as it says in here somewhere, we say, well, that didn't make sense, or that was crazy, or we just get confused, something like that. But he asked the question in the second paragraph on 121, what is confirmed through this single-minded sameness? And it's just kind of a provocative list of things he says, especially that first, the first couple of answers he gives. Says what's confirmed may be the particular manifestations of tradition, such as sacred scripture, authoritative texts, or well-established customs. So if you say, well, I rely on a tradition, on a religious tradition or a spiritual tradition, according to this analysis, you are really confirming the momentum of the story, and you're making recognition that much more difficult. Or he says it may be a discipline or methodology for knowing, such as the scientific method. Again, the scientific method is all about discovery and inquiry, but he's saying at a certain level, at the level that we're interested in anyway, it confirms knowing and eliminates the possibility for a different kind of recognition. And then he talks about the fundamental stories that confirm personal identity or confirm the deepest structures of consciousness. He describes the result. In each case, the mechanism works in the same way. We cannot know. We do not have the answer. We cannot think what is new. Bound to the results of the process, we have no access to the process itself. And then he does give one clue, because the question is always, okay, but what can we do about it? And he says, at most, we may sense its operation in a vague fear or anxiety. And that's not a bad clue. When something makes you kind of nervous or anxious or I would say, negative in any way. You know, whenever there is something, the tone of your experience has a kind of a negative flavor to it, there's an opportunity there if you're willing to break through the surface dimension of that negativity. There's the opportunity to ask, what's going on? You know, it's as though you are... I don't know if this is quite the right image, but if you imagine that that you're on a ship and you've kind of forgotten that the ship is moving, and as a result, everything feels very stable. But sometimes you tune into the movement of the ship, and you begin to get kind of queasy and seasick. That's an opportunity, because now you know that you're on a ship, and that the ship is moving, and that you're in an ocean. And that takes us back to a very famous Buddhist metaphor, which is that samsara is like an ocean in which we're drowning. Okay. Well, let's see, should we go on, or are we at the end of, I mean, we are kind of at the end of our time. I guess I'll make one more point just because it relates to what I was just saying. Here he talks about the fear or anxiety, which is kind of a clue. And then on page 125, he describes all this in similar terms, and all of those could be pointers too. It actually starts, and it's a kind of a summary statement, starts at the bottom of page 124. He talks about living in a shadow world. And it's this world that's been conducted into place. Right? This conducted shadow world is one of limits and darkness. It offers pain and numbness, confusion and dullness, anxiety and emotionality. Oh, I don't think I can bear to keep reading. It just goes. but then he talks about it keeps the mind agitated and heavy. And he talks about the whispers that go on that kind of keep all this going, right? Their murmurs go on endlessly, shaping the space of appearance. A narrow, heavy pressure builds, pushing toward confusion. There's no imagination, no creativity, no delight. We do not know how to conduct our lives. So, that's the problem, and throughout this, I think we've been looking at some ways to work with that. In the rest of the chapter, which we're going to deal with next week, we move more in that direction. So, that's it for today. Next class is our last class, and maybe we can talk a little bit next week about how to go on, too.